Okay, Butch, we ready to go? call the meeting to order, 10 after 3. House S. We have with today Representative Herron, Representative Seaton, Representative Dick, and Representative Cartula, and myself, Representative Keller. We have four bills we'd like to do today. One of them, SCR 7, Fetal Alcohol Spectrum Disorder Awareness Day, and that is Senator Myers. He's going to be coming up and presenting that. What I'd hope to do, of course, is the will of the committee. I'd like to see us move SCR 7, and then we'll have three bills after that that will get on the record, and it'll be more for just getting the questions out there, and anybody that went out of their way to testify, we'll try to accommodate, but get them all on the record anyway. So if you would, Senator Myers,
very good.
Identify yourself and give us the presentation. Thanks.
Will do. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the HESS committee. It's good to be back. For the record, my name is Kevin Meyer, and I'm a senator from South Anchorage, and with me is my staff, Christine Marisagan. And the resolution that we have before you today is one you've seen before. And in fact, what we're thinking about doing is next year bringing this forward as a bill and just put it in statute to make September 9th as the Fetal Alcohol Spectrum Disorders Awareness Day, because this is September 9th is a internationally recognized day for FASD, and it's simply a reminder that on the ninth day, that a woman should restrain from alcohol during the 9 months of pregnancy. I've had the honor of participating in the FASD awareness event. It's a state event held in Anchorage at the Lusac Library, and presenting the resolution to the group each year. And it's been an honor to do that representing the legislature, because we get together at 9:09 on the ninth month, ninth day, and in recognition of individuals and families that have children with FASD. And as you know, FASD is caused by prenatal exposure to alcohol. It can and does create permanent brain damage, birth defects, learning disabilities, behavioral problems, and most tragically is the loss of one's individual potential. And unfortunately, in Alaska, we have the highest known rate of FASD in the United States. And what's so frustrating and irritating to me is totally preventable. You know, some birth defects or some learning disabilities can't be helped, but this one is totally preventable. And it's a big problem in this state of Alaska, but we as a state have tackled other big problems, like driving while intoxicated, smoking tobacco, and through the education process, we've made great strides in reducing the driving while intoxicated and smoking, and that's my goal here, is just through education, we're going to get the word out that you know, don't drink while you're pregnant. So that's the goal with this resolution. Again, it's just to make people more aware, educate people about FASD, and with that, I'll conclude my comments and want to thank the committee for considering this resolution.
Well, thank you for taking the work to put it before us. It's one of the most effective awareness days we could have. The awareness is, this one seems to me disproportionately important. Any questions from the committee? Representative Herron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No question, just a comment to the sponsor is, Senator, I appreciate your leadership and your championing of this issue. It does take role models, and I appreciate you being one of them.
Thank you.
Okay, we have a few people to testify. If you like, you can stay right there, and we'll see. We'll have one off-net and one here in the room. But
thank you.
Let's go off-net first. Gene Gerhardt, service. Gene, are you online? If you are, just identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Jean Gerhardt Cyrus. I live in Kiana, Alaska, and I am a parent of multiple children with prenatal exposure to alcohol. I would like to thank Senator Myers for sponsoring this resolution, and I very much support the idea of having a bill that establishes this ongoing. And I think the awareness for this important issue is not only for the women, but also for all their support people, for partners and coworkers and family, because it really does take support people to help women maintain sobriety during those important months. FASD, as you know, is the only cause, is only caused by alcohol exposure. It is a lifelong disability. It does not go away, and it does definitely impact all systems, including economic, and I believe the weight of human potential is extreme. It is the most common cause of mental retardation. However, ironically, the majority of people with that are living with the effects of prenatal exposure function much higher and therefore do not qualify for developmental disability services or special education in our schools. So they tend to suffer not only from the primary disability, which is caused by the damage that alcohol does to the brain and the changes that are caused, but by secondary characteristics, which occur as a result of poor fit with the environment. When someone does not look like they have a disability, and not everybody with prenatal exposure has outward physical features, then they often are disserved through systems and have develop mental health problems, disrupted school experience, trouble with the law, inappropriate sexual behavior, alcohol and drug problems, and the list goes on and on. Prevention and early intervention is definitely our best strategy, and not only for this generation, but for generations to come, because the impact, even if somebody is exposed, not drink during pregnancy, the impact on their functioning, on the lives of their children, and so on, is impacted. So again, I want to very much thank you for supporting this important resolution.
And thank you, Jean, for calling in. Representative Curtula, did you have a question for Jean? Go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a really quick question. Maybe I misheard, but I thought that you were saying that children with FASD don't qualify for special education. And what I'm wondering is that the children that haven't been found to have FASD because they're so normal looking, et cetera, or is it because, is that right? Even if you've got the diagnosis and you know that the child's FASD, that they still don't qualify for special education?
Representative Kurt Kulis, through the chair. Unfortunately, there are a couple of issues. One is diagnosis is not available everywhere, particularly in a lot of the rural communities. The other is if people don't recognize or don't acknowledge the impact that FASD has on a child, the only way someone with an FASD diagnosis can qualify for special education, unless they have learning issues, is under the classification of other health impaired. If the schools are not aware or the parents are not aware that this is a route they can pursue, it just doesn't happen. And a lot of people with prenatal exposure, when the issues first start to arise, they're behavioral. As I said, a lot of people with prenatal exposure function very well in terms of academics, but it's the social and behavioral issues. And rather than that being looked at as a learning issue, it's looked at as a discipline issue. And that sets the student up, the child up, for discipline rather than support. And so getting the word out and educating people about the impact can go a long way, and that's a lot of advocating that I do in educating parents.
Thank you for explaining it.
And another one, Representative Heron.
Thanks, Chairman. On that point, I think that she has explained it very well, is that people by nature can mask things, but it's when it's demonstrated by behavior, and then the child is dealt with in, as she explained, in a way that has nothing to do with FASD. And that's where the child gets defeated. They're not treating, they think they're treating a discipline problem when it's really something else. And so I appreciate her testimony. That hit the nail on the head.
Thank you, Representative Heron. I also want to point out that the advisory board on alcohol and drug abuse, we're going to be hearing from them in a little bit, but they provided that great study, the McDowell study that we all have in front of us. And like they described the difference between FAS and FASD and some of the difficulties that you explained. So thank you, Gene. Appreciate you taking time out of your day to talk to the committee. And thank you for your good testimony.
Thank you very much.
Kate Burkhart, you're in the room. If you would, come up. She is the executive director for the advisory board on alcoholism and drug abuse, and she's just loaded with wisdom. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Now, before you start, Kate, I wanted to acknowledge that Representative Millett has joined us, and I'd forgotten to do that, so forgive me, but go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Kate Burkhart, and I'm the executive director of the advisory board on alcoholism and drug abuse, and my comments today are on behalf of my board, as well as the Alaska FASD Partnership, of which we are a founding member. Ms. Gearhart Cyrus is also a member and on the steering committee. And both those organizations support the resolution to declare September 9th, 2011, Fetal Alcohol Spectrum Disorders Awareness Day. We appreciate the advocacy of Senator Meyer and the fact that the resolution creates an opportunity for the legislature to publicly recognize the impact of fetal alcohol spectrum disorder on Alaskan children, families, communities, schools, workplaces, and the social services network. The resolution is not just about preventing FASD, which I think we've done a very good job of explaining to Alaskans that FASD is preventable. But we especially appreciate that the resolution goes on to include a resolution to increase identification of children with FASD, to address some of the issues that Ms. Gearhart Cyrus pointed out, and to improve the lives of those affected by fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. It is through resolutions like this and the leadership of the legislature and legislators like Senator Meyer that we have been able to expand the way that we engage in FASD prevention. One of our annual events that our board does is in conjunction with the Cabaret Hotel Restaurant and Retailers Association, the Alcohol Industry Association, and individual alcohol retailers. On this day, we place educational and awareness materials on tables, and the retailers and industry members agree to provide free non-alcoholic beverages to women who are pregnant as a way to help encourage better choices and to educate folks on how they can prevent FASD. And it's only because of leadership like what we see here in this resolution that we're able to do that sort of thing, because you are encouraging Alaskans to work together to prevent FASD. So both organizations are wholeheartedly in support, and I am encouraged by Senator Meyer's allusion to a permanent declaration, perhaps in a bill. Thank you.
Any questions for Kate? Don't see any.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anybody else in the room that would like to testify on SCR 7? Anybody else online that would like to testify on SCR 7? If not, we're going to close public testimony. The committee comments or questions or discussions?
Move it.
Move. Yep. Representative Dick, if you would, make a motion, and we'll move it. If you have more of those green slips, you can pass them down.
Well, Beth.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I move that we Senate SCR number 727-LS0700/A, then we move from committee.
Seeing no objection, SCR 7 moves from committee. May they always be as easy for you, Senator Meyer. Rather, in light of time, because we have four bills, we'll just kind of do the paperwork as we go here. If you would, Representative Heron or whoever's going to present, get set up and you can do it from there is fine. You know, or Liz maybe or whoever, but get set up. So.
Chairman, are we on the record?
Yes, we're still on the record.
Thank you for allowing us to have this introduction hearing, and it would be an interim project for my staff, but at this time I'd ask Jane to come forward. Jane is an intern. She is soon to be a graduate of DePaul and has been a great addition to my office, and so I'm going to ask her to present the bill to you, sir. Thank you.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Jane Ann Bohr, and I'm interning as a staffer for Representative Heron this session. First and foremost, I'd like to thank the chairman for scheduling this bill and the committee for taking the time to take a look at our legislation. The bill before us today is House Bill 209, an act requiring a healthcare insurer to provide coverage for tobacco cessation treatment. I think we all know that tobacco dependence is a chronic and lasting condition that negatively affects the health, productivity, and well-being of Alaskans and their loved ones. Statistics from our Department of Health and Social Services show that tobacco is a leading cause of death in Alaska. Tobacco kills more Alaskans each year than suicide, motor vehicle crashes, chronic liver disease, cirrhosis, homicide, and HIV/AIDS combined. In addition to the negative effect tobacco addiction has on the lifespan of Alaskans, it also has a significant economic cost. In 2007, tobacco use cost Alaskans $314 million in direct medical expenditures and an additional $177 million in lost productivity due to tobacco-related deaths. This bill gives Alaskans the resources and support they need to end tobacco addiction. It requires that insurance companies provide smoking cessation programs to Alaskans who wish to be free from tobacco addiction. Statistics show that 70% of Alaskans try to end tobacco addiction every year. To be successful, these people need as much support as possible. With the implementation of HB 209, insurance companies would provide coverage for a minimum of two courses of cessation treatment during each year. Coverage provides for not less than four counseling sessions within each course of treatment, as well as over-the-counter or prescribed medication by the U.S. FDA. Multiple courses per year allow for multiple attempts to quit smoking. Counseling is not a precondition for receiving medication. Therefore, patients may tailor treatment plans to any individual needs or preferences that they may have. Data show that plans wherein people can choose different courses are generally more successful. Also, coverage for treatment may not require pre-authorization or require a referral. On a final note, our office recognizes that nobody enjoys mandates that confine the choices of Alaskans or Alaskan business. However, it's our opinion that this bill gives Alaskans the support they need to free themselves from tobacco addiction. The long-term benefits of this bill far outweigh short-term costs, and some of these benefits include longer lifespans. Some statistics show that people who quit smoking live an average of 7 years longer than people who do not. Other benefits include higher work productivity, lower long-term medical expenditures for individuals and for insurers, and healthier, happier Alaskans. And I think everybody in this entire room can say that they're for healthier and happier Alaskans. In some cases, one may even argue that a lack of mandates can increase costs for health insurers. For instance, if somebody has a medical problem that goes unchecked because an insurer doesn't cover it, in the long term, that may actually cost more. The intent of House Bill 209 is to posit long-lasting, positive change that will benefit all Alaskans. Giving Alaskans the opportunity to end tobacco addiction gives them the chance to live longer, happier lives. This bill provides for an inexpensive preventative measure for what are extremely expensive long-term costs of tobacco addiction. To the committee, thank you again for taking the time to hear our legislation. When we hear testimony, I expect all parties will want to get a little more detail-oriented. But for the moment being, I'm available for any initial questions and reactions you might have. And it's my belief that there's also somebody online, Kathy Alaley from the Department of Health and Social Services, if there are any questions that I'm unable to answer.
Yeah, before we go to Kathy, and Emily Neenan is also here from the American Cancer Society. Is there any questions for the sponsor or the sponsor's representative? Did you have a comment?
A comment to staff is for my colleagues on the committee. Jane, do other states have these type of programs, and what is their success experience?
Sure, there are five other states in the United States that have programs like this, and the leader is Oregon. They implemented a program that's similar in 1996, and their smoking statistics for adults decreased by 26%.
I'm sorry, what? How many percent?
26.
26% decrease, and is that attributed just to the insurance mandate that it's covered, do you think? I mean, is that pretty?
I'm sure there's a variety of factors if you look at the cost of cigarettes and everything, but in the study I read, a statistically significant portion was attributable to the programs.
A related question on that. What is the typical cost for how much costs quit smoking? Yeah.
Sure.
One of these programs.
Sure. Well, I know that the cost isn't significant. I've read statistics anywhere from 66 cents to $1.20 a year.
That's for the increase in the insurance costs spread across everybody. If I just decide to quit smoking on my own, a Nicorette, there's other things. Would you describe the treatment a little bit to me and what it costs?
Sure. I can give you a preliminary description of treatments. I'm actually a non-smoker, so I don't know a whole lot about the different treatments. But there are different methodologies. One is gum, and that's Nicorette. There's also a patch. I'm sure you've all seen commercials for these things. And the patch includes drugs like Nicoderm, Habitrol, Prostep, and Nicotrol. There's an inhaler, which is also Nicotrol. And the patch and the inhaler are prescription drugs. The gum is over-the-counter. There's a nasal spray, which I had never heard about. That's also Nicotrol. And there's a lozenge, which is an over-the-counter drug.
Any other questions from the committee? Remember now, he wants all the tough questions now, so we can work on them all summer. So.
I do have a question. If somebody were to take treatment, what's the still people go back to smoking again? Do you have a statistic on if we put up the money for that, how successful are those programs?
Sure. I don't have the statistics right with me, so I'll get back to the committee with exact statistics. We actually have a litany of studies showing different statistics and success rates and failures. One thing that's great about the bill is that we do allow for more than one course of treatment per year. So it allows for four counseling programs within two courses of treatment per year. So the idea is that you'll have multiple attempts to quit should you need them.
Right off the top of your head, the information on who this, what percentage of people this would apply to if this mandate passes, who would be covered, how many of the, I figured you did. If you would, put that on the record, because the question is always on the insurance mandate. We passed this, we have no jurisdiction over the ERISA plans, self-employed plans. We don't have any jurisdiction over the Medicaid. Medicare, we're just talking private insurance. So if you would put that information on the record as far as how many you think this would affect.
Of course. For state mandated insurance, you're looking at about 15%. Individual insurance plans are about 34%. And whether or not it would apply to all individual plans is questionable. I spoke with Linda Hall, our director of the Division of Insurance, and it also turns out that the population covered by ERISA is also covered by the PPACA, and they already are requiring tobacco cessation treatment. So basically what this bill does is it puts a little more detail into it for the mandated insurance companies.
Thank you for being ready for that question. Anything else? If not, Representative Seaton.
Thank you. And I was just wondering, does this would cover the state insurance policy and the retiree insurance policy?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, yes, it would.
We have online Kathy, let's see if I can say this, Alleli, from the Department of Public Health, Division of Health, or Department of Health Social Services, Division of Public Health, there we go. Kathy, are you online? If so, would you identify yourself and give us your testimony?
This is Kathy Alloway. For the record, I'm Section Chief of Chronic Disease Prevention and Health Promotion, and I'm just here to answer questions.
Okay. Emily, did you want to testify, or are you just going to answer questions for the American Cancer Society?
Well, you'll have some good questions, so I'll go ahead and testify. For the record, this is Emily Neenan. I'm the Alaska Government Relations Director for the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. And I'm sure that no one on the committee is surprised that we do support this legislation, as do a number of other health groups in the state. I thank Representative Herron for bringing this forward. This is one more piece in tackling the issues around tobacco in the state. As I mentioned in the letter that you all have, the easiest way to deal with cessation is to actually keep kids from ever starting to smoke, because we know it's tough to quit. One of the advantages of insurance coverage for cessation services is that every additional piece of support a tobacco user gets increases their chances of success. Takes an average tobacco user upwards of 7 tries at quitting before they quit for good. So I always encourage folks that are trying to quit and let them know that every time they quit, their chances of staying quit improve, and every resource they avail themselves of will increase their chances of a successful quit. And that's what we're looking for, and trying to chip away at this issue. We've had tremendous success with a lot of the prevention and control programs over the last number of years, and this is another piece that we believe can be helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Emily. I have one more question for the sponsor. Would you show me in the bill where this covers the state plan? I'm missing that. Is it just that is that incorporated in? So any healthcare insurer? I didn't think we could do that. I don't think we can. From what I understood in the past, I didn't think we had that jurisdiction.
Through the chair, I'll have to get back to you on that. But I don't think the language in the bill will actually outline all healthcare insurers. I think the bill that basically will speak to the state-mandated health
insurers. Okay, we can answer that later. But as I understood it, we didn't even have that option. Now, that isn't to say that we don't unofficially get the commitment sometimes that the state will do it, I want to acknowledge Representative Holmes and Representative Guerra, who are in the audience. Thank you for coming. Where are you? Okay. Waiting for their bills. Thank you for reminding me. Representative Seaton.
Thank you. I had one other question, and that is on page 2, line 3, where it's coverage for the cessation treatment may not require an individual to obtain pre-authorization from the health insurance carrier. What is the purpose for that provision?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, that provision merely makes sure that everybody is going to get the treatment. if you require pre-authorization for the treatment, then it's possible that some people will be excluded. So that's just ensuring that anybody who is a smoker is going to be eligible for the treatment, and they don't need an extra step.
Mr. Chairman, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I guess what I'm doing is looking at on lines 9 through 11, the bill requires, you know, can't be more restrictive than the financial limitations for medical or surgical benefits, including payments, deductibles, and co-payments. And so I think that a lot of times part of the pre-authorization is for the knowledge of what the co-payments and the deductibles and all those things are for. So as you investigate this further over the interim, you know, I would like to specifically look at the portion on the pre-authorization and to find out whether that is something that is critical or whether there's almost a conflict between those two sections. And appreciate that, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, Representative Seaton, I see a thumbs up signal from the sponsor that he got it. That's great. Any other comments before we set this bill aside and go to the next one? Is there anyone else in the room that would like to testify on, what are we on? 201? 209. It should be 209. Anybody else online? Oh, Representative Couture.
I have just one quick last question, and that is, it appears like in the first part of the bill that you've noted that the coverage must include the cost of tobacco cessation counseling sessions, and then under C3 that you cannot require the counseling sessions. And I just wondered how other states do it. Do they require individuals to go to the counseling as well? And maybe for the summer, are there any statistics on how well one works versus the other?
Representative Kutula, through the chair, I know that the program's different throughout the five states. Mm-hmm. The model legislation that we used was from Washington and partly from Oregon. And in those programs, you could have either or. So it's very similar. And the purpose for that is simply so that people can choose the best treatment for them and whatever works, you know, with their time schedules or their personalities or preferences.
Thank you.
Seeing no other questions, thank you very much. And thank you to the sponsor for bringing the bill. And we'll move to HB 61, Representative Holmes. Moving forward. And just before you start, we have Dr. Hurlburt, our public health chief medical officer, here in the room to answer questions, and Jill Lewis, public health, for questions, and several testifiers. So, if you would, identify yourself for the record and tell us all about HB 61.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you to the members of the committee for hearing this bill. My name is Lindsay Holmes. I'm a representative from House District 26. This bill will be familiar to some of you. It was heard in this committee last year. I was going to make a few opening statements, and then, Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I was going to turn it over to James Waldo from my office to walk you through the sections of the bill. This bill has to do with advanced health care directives, which are known colloquially to most people as living wills. They lay out for you your end of life wishes and your health care wishes, and they often designate who may make decisions for you if you're unable to make them for your own health care. I have one of these, Mr. Chairman, and a couple of years ago I was having dinner with some people and they were telling me a horror story about how they'd been traveling outside of the state and something catastrophic had happened and a member of the family ended up in the hospital. That individual had a living will, but the living will was unfortunately locked in a safe or a drawer back at their house in Alaska, and they were not able to access it. And so the person was incapacitated, and the people who were supposed to be authorized to make decisions for him or her didn't have that authorization with them. And I thought to myself, well, I have a living will, and it's locked in the safe in my father's basement. Mm-hmm. And if something, God forbid, were to happen to me and I would be rushed to Bartlett Hospital, how would they know that I had a living will, who they should call, where they should find it? And I talked to some people, and they said, well, that's not a problem because you can just go down to Providence or Alaska Regional in Anchorage, and you can register it. And I said, well, that's nice, but can I? But what if I'm in Juneau? What if I'm in Fairbanks? What if I'm in Nome? What if I'm out of state? So, Mr. Chairman, this bill is our attempt to help people make their living wills actually useful by creating a registry that would be housed in the Department of Health and Social Services, be entirely voluntary. No person would be mandated to have a living will. No person would be mandated, even if they had one, to submit it to the state. And it would still be completely valid even if you chose not to submit it to the state. This is just a voluntary tool. For those who want to, they could take a copy of their living will to the Department of Health and Social Services. The department would basically scan it and put it into an online registry, and secure 24-hour online access would be given to hospitals and other healthcare facilities in the state, so that if something were to happen and somebody were to be admitted, the hospital could do it, run a quick query, entirely free to the hospital or healthcare provider, run a quick query, find out whether or not that person had a living will, and actually access it right there in real time. And if you're out of state, although you still wouldn't have the 24/7 access, you would still during business hours be able to call the Department of Health and Social Services and get a copy faxed down to you. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I was, with your permission, going to turn the microphone over to James Waldo to actually run you through a sectional analysis.
Okay, sure. If we could, though, ask maybe, and if you said this, I might have been distracted, but how many states have done this? I mean, is this some new idea? Or?
No, Mr. Chairman, this is not a new idea. And, in fact, this bill went through some really good tweaks in cooperation with the Department of Health and Social Services last year, because we did a search through our Council of State Governments, our legislative research, and James Waldo can tell you more on exactly how many states have done it. But we have found there actually is a company out there who can do this for us cheaper and more efficiently than Health and Social Services. We've given them the ability to contract, and James Waldo, I think, can tell you exactly how many other states do have a similar program. There are a number of them.
We never, I don't think we got a fiscal note, but that's probably because they wanted some clarification on what the intent of the bill was before. There was any.
Chairman, the fiscal note showed up about 15 minutes ago.
Oh. And how many hundreds of thousands of dollars is it?
The setup costs. I haven't seen it. Mr. Chairman.
Oh, that's all right. We can get
the
to that.
The setup in the initial first year for the setup costs, Mr. Chairman, the fiscal note has a total of $194,800. And then it starts to go down rapidly, and in the outline years, it's $82,400 a year for a part-time, for a half-time employee, and the costs of being part of the online registry.
Okay. Seeing no other questions immediately, go right ahead. Thanks. Identify yourself for the record and start going through the details.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. My name is James R. Waldo. I'm staff to Representative Lindsay Holmes. To answer your first question, we did have legislative research prepare for us a report on what various states do as far as advanced health care directives and registries for them. It's not always exactly the same, because every state's laws are going to look a little bit different, but they identified at least seven states: Arizona, California, Montana, Nevada, North Carolina, Washington, and Vermont. Many of those are West Coast states. That already participate or have their own state centralized registry. I think it would probably be interesting to see how many more states are actually looking at developing one right now, and I think your question gives me something to look at in the future. But as far as the sectional analysis for the bill goes, I can just walk the committee through that. For you, Mr. Chairman, if you remember from last year, actually most of the good work we did on this bill ended up being done right here in the HES committee, and it moved later to Judiciary, where almost nothing. We had pretty much a finished product by the time we moved it out of HES. But the bill is two sections. The first section is really very easy to understand and pretty simple. It just protects healthcare facilities from liability, either for accessing or not accessing the registry. We wanted this to be purely informational. We don't want anybody to be punished either for looking at it or not looking at it whenever anybody's a patient in their facility. Section 2 is really the meat of the bill, and this is where it sets into law and statute how the registry is going to work. And so there are a number of sort of discrete sections, A through L, that kind of explain the various pieces. To start off with, in A, you have you know, we're saying it's, we're creating the authorization for the registry within the Department of Health and Social Services. B basically establishes that it's voluntary, as you can see through the use of the term may. We go on further in C to reiterate the confidentiality of it, which is a very important piece because although I'm very interested in my doctor seeing my advanced healthcare directive, I don't know that I'm interested in anybody else looking at it necessarily. And as far as the confidentiality goes, it is available online on the web to hospitals in the state, which we felt was probably the best choice because they are a finite number of entities we can identify. They're trustworthy. They deal with medical records already, and they have those confidentiality protections already established. As far as individuals, you can get your own healthcare directive from the department once it's in the registry, or if, for example, I'm my grandmother's agent identified in her directive, I could also get it from the registry for her, which is important because if she's incapacitated, she's probably not going to be able to call them up and ask for it. Then if you look to Section D, that's where it talks about it being available, viewable online for hospitals in the state, sort of 24 hours a day for emergencies. E deals with sort of the legal nature of these directives. We wanted to make it clear that the Department of Health and Social Services doesn't need to verify these for their validity. They don't need to verify them and make sure that they're perfectly legal or what the legal ramifications of them are. They're just keeping it on file purely informationally. F deals with the removal of a directive from the registry. And we wanted to make it very clear that because participation in this is voluntary, an individual could remove their directive from the registry at any time and without cost. In fact, if you look to H, skipping over G there, it says that they can charge a fee for filing a directive, but they cannot charge a fee for removing your directive. So if you say, I don't want to participate any longer, there can be no fee attached to that. Moving back to Section G, it says, filing or not filing with the registry doesn't affect the validity of your directive. If you choose to keep it at home in your safe or in your wallet or in file with your hospital but not put it in the registry, it has the exact same legal weight as a directive that is placed inside the registry. And that, again, is with the voluntary nature of the registry. If you look at I, this is authorizing language that deals with the Department of Health and Social Services writing regulations sort of to protect the security of the registry, because that's always a moving target and technology advances sometimes faster than legislation does. We wanted to make sure that the department could provide regulations to guarantee that this material is safe, secure, and remains confidential. And J is sort of the exact same thing, but has to do with identifying who the proper person to access a directive might be. Whereas I talks about sort of the cybersecurity aspect, this talks about the human security aspect. When I call up and say, my grandmother has her directive in the registry, my name is James R. Waldo, and I'm her surrogate, can you please provide me a copy? The department will say, excellent, James, and then they'll have regulations in place to make sure that I am who is identified. We'll get it to you as soon as you tell us your date of birth, the place you were born, your grandmother's secret passcode, or whatever they put in place that makes the most sense for the department and works the best for the registry. As far as K and L, K is just another sort of liability section exempting the department from liability in regard to the registry. And L is merely a definitional section that says when we say directive, we mean advanced healthcare directive, and when we say registry, we mean the registry that we're putting together in this bill. And if you have any questions, Mr. Chairman or members of the committee, I'd be happy to answer them.
Well, I'll start out with one, and I'm sure there may be more. help me interpret on page 2, lines 3 and 4. It may be the time of the day and the time of the year, but I read that about 6 times and I found myself confused. Is that an agent?
Page 2, lines 3 and 4 is B, an individual who has made a written directive for the individual may file the directive with the registry. That is actually just sort of, we create the registry in A, and then in B, although the registry is already created, we need another section that says, now that it exists, we need to say who can put their directives there. And by that individual, that would be me. So I create it, I can file it with the registry.
Okay. So there's one individual here, not two individuals.
Precisely.
That's where I was running.
Mr. Chairman, I read that over again last night and thought, that's kind of awkward language. But yes, I believe it's referring to the same individual.
We may want to, you know, not that, I mean, unless I'm the only one that misunderstood, you might want to look at that sometime.
And Mr. Chairman, to clarify a little further, if you look down to, for example, lines 12 and 13, where they're discussing who may access a registry, whenever they refer to the agent, guardian, or surrogate of an individual, they always refer to them as the agent, guardian, or surrogate of the individual with the directive. And I think that B section is very specific, that it is only the individual who can file it with the registry, so that we make sure that it's coming from the right person.
Any other questions for the sponsor? If we go back to the part on page 3 there, we don't, I mean, there's a lot of, it very specifically gives the department the responsibility for the security and what else? There's two things there, the identification procedures, whatever, whatever. And I, just for what it's worth, it'll go back to page 2, line 14 and 15. If it's a facility that calls the state, you know, then I'm presuming in the whole of the bill here, you're thinking that the department would determine who in the facility would be authorized to call and get the information. And a question, it is a question, that is, should we be more specific here, saying that a person's doctor or a nurse that it, or something, you know, rather than saying a facility, because obviously the facility isn't going to call, it's going to be somebody at the facility. And I realize that I think you were thinking anyway that that was totally in the department's hands. And that's a question I'd like you to at least think about. You don't have to respond now, you know, because it's a.
Mr. Chairman, in answer to your question, if you look at lines 14 through 16, it says, a healthcare facility in this state or a hospital in this state if the individual who made the directive is a patient of the healthcare facility or hospital. So it requires, so it can't just be any hospital calling up. It has to be a hospital where James Waldo has shown up as a patient for them to get my directive. And then it would sort of be up to the regulations of the department, I imagine, to determine how they're going to figure out that I'm a patient there. I would also say that it's probably going to be my doctor calling to make that request.
I'm trying not to stray into the gnat, but you know, we have the department here listening to, and they can add comment or, you know, ignore it either way, and I will be happy. I just wanted to, it was a question I had when I read it. And let's go back up on page 2, line 5 through 8, except as provided in this subsection by and by D. So, the in other words, this is confidential except for what it lays out here from line 5 down through line 25. That's the cases where this is not confidential, right? And it says that the department or contractor may not use the information for any other purpose, and I was wondering about would that prevent them from providing the information to somebody else other than what you have authorized? You know, I just wondering about the use of the word "use." You know, I was wondering if it shouldn't be. May not use or provide or the information or something like that, except as specified here. But Anyway, I'm just kind of telling you that the confusion that I had a little bit as I read it, you know, thinking about that word use. Any other questions? Representative Seaton.
Thanks. If the department finds it costs $3.82 to do, is that the fee that they would charge? I mean, is where on page 3, lines 7 and 8, the fee may not exceed the department's administrative costs in fulfilling the request. Is that as specific? I mean, is it being that specific?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, yes. The department is not required to charge a fee. The department is allowed to charge a fee. And we just said that, yes, the fees cannot exceed the actual administrative costs. So that is correct. And Mr. Chairman, Representative Seaton, the intent of this is we're trying to make this as low cost for the public as possible to encourage people to put their registries in. It's also why we're not charging the hospitals to access this, is because the last thing we want to do is charge the hospitals and have them say, okay, well, then we're just not going to use this system. The whole point is to encourage the use of the system and make it as affordable for everybody as possible.
Okay. And Representative Seaton? Do we have some kind of a ballpark estimate of what other states that have this in place, what their costs are? I might just not have seen that in the background material, but.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, that was not in the ledge research report we ordered, but it is an excellent question. I know that at least three of the other seven states participate in a national database that's run by a corporation, and I do know that that's significantly more expensive, I think. As far as what it costs other states to run their own centralized registries, I can tell you Arizona's is far more comprehensive than what we've laid out. For example, they will produce a report of the directive that has been received, mail that back to the individual with a card attached for the individual to sign and indicate that they've input all the information into their system correctly, and then send that back to the department for their verification. And originally, when we had our first sort of incarnation of the bill, last legislature, the department initially thought, that our Department of Health and Social Services thought along those lines, but we've pared it back significantly from there. I think our initial fiscal notes were 2 to 3 times what the current fiscal note is. And so it certainly could be more expensive if we wanted to have a luxury car edition. But this is sort of a simple conclusion.
Great. Representative Seaton.
So my understanding is now a person will fill out the forms, and then that'll just be scanned into the registry. So whatever information the individual provides, and the department is not going to be responsible for checking any of the validity or the correctness of the information. It's just going to be scanned in and put into the registry. And that's why it's cheaper than this back and forth and verified information. Is that right?
Absolutely. Representative Seaton, through the chair. We didn't want to, you know, have attorneys spending their time looking it over and making sure all the T's were crossed and I's were dotted.
Thank you. I think it's pretty clear, and we will set the bill aside, look at the fiscal note, think it over, and if you, you know, be happy to work with you. Anything I see, and I'm sure knowing the committee, any one of us would, and you'll have the minutes. And
Mr. Chairman, were we going to take any public testimony on the bill today?
Yeah.
You said set the bill aside. I was just wanting to clarify.
Okay, I was getting ahead of myself. But we have Marie Darlin in the room, and we'll start there, ARP, and then we have Emily online, Emily Needham from the American Cancer Society. Welcome. Identify yourself for the record and go ahead.
My name is Marie Darlin, and I'm representing AARP. And just want to say that we definitely support this bill and have testified on it before, but you will be getting another letter of support to your committee. And want to say that considering that it took us years to get the advanced directives, let's say, in statute, which was a lot of work over several sessions, actually, this is the next step that's needed because of all the information you've just been provided about the reasons for it, how it would work, and we know that there are some hospitals in the state. I know Bartlett, for one, has joined a registry group where they will put your advanced directives into that registry, but I don't know what other hospitals are doing, but I just found that out in the last couple of weeks, which I think is a good idea, because at least that's one more step, but that's only one hospital, our hospital here. So I do think that this is one way of answering this problem of what happens if you do become ill somewhere else, or how does some hospital access your records. And so I think the bill has covered everything that really would be a concern to most anybody and to those people who are going to have to take care of how this is done. But the fact that, as we say in here, medical emergencies can happen any time, and I was at a meeting recently where that happened with a couple, such as was described before, that they were lucky that they were registered through Bartlett here to this national registry so that it was available and they didn't have a problem. But they indicated, you know, what if we hadn't and what would have happened. So this is just one way of trying to, as we say, take this to the next step of where these directives then are available for whoever is going to need them. And you will find really that a lot of those are going to be your more elderly people too, who for one reason or another will need to have this information available to whenever they need it. And so therefore we want to say that we do support it. And hopefully, you know, this will become a part of our statutes also. So I don't have anything else to add.
Any questions for Marie? No. Representative Petula?
Thank you, and thanks for clarifying about Bartlett. I thought that we had this at Bartlett, so that's for any place in the nation. If we call our hospital, they can release a directive. Is that how it works there?
Through the chair, yes, Representative Petula. As I understand it from this, and actually I was furnished with, in writing, the requirements that they have, you know, for you, and as I remember right, there isn't even a charge. You take it to Bartlett, and they in turn have it then registered on this registry, which it's some kind of a national group that actually does this. And so it is available, let's say, if you check to find out what your hospital does with those directives. And some hospitals, well, even I know Bartlett at one time said, we don't keep them here because I asked. They said, no, you keep them. But this was prior to them actually now being able to register it on another registry.
Thank you.
Thank you. For the sponsor, James, I would really enjoy, just put this on the record, I would really enjoy knowing how many national registers are available and what there is out there. I'll ask you a question too, Marie, on this. Does ARP, have you heard anything where, does ARP sponsor a registry? You know, it'd be a shame to recreate the wheel here, you know, so we got to look at this, at least what's available out there.
Pat might be able to answer that better than me, but as far as I know, AARP is not.
Yeah. Okay.
They're not one of those groups, unless Pat wants to correct me.
But, okay, great.
We are not. And I have no idea what these, you know, even what this one registry for Bartlett is.
Right. Yeah. Representative Heron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maria, I just wanted to make a comment. You are a frequent flyer in front of this committee, and appreciate all the issues that you're advocating for and part of your organization. But today, it seems like that you're very knowledgeable on this one, regardless of AARP.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, AARP and several other organizations worked very hard to get the advanced directives actually into statute.
Thank you.
So it goes back a ways.
Thank you so much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Emily, are you still standing by online?
Hello again.
If you would identify yourself and give us your testimony.
Yes. Thank you, Chairman Keller. For the record, my name is Emily Neenan. I'm the Alaska Government Relations Director for the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. Normally, I leave the personal stories on legislation to my volunteers, but if the committee will indulge me, I'd like to share that my organization does support this legislation, and I'd like to share my personal reasons for supporting the legislation. My father, Lieutenant Colonel Hunt Neenan, was career Air Force. He was a meteorologist and pilot. He was an airborne troop carrier. He was a World War II veteran. And yes, I am his youngest daughter. He flew reconnaissance the night before D-Day, and his Purple Heart came from D-Day, the D-Day invasion where his plane was shot at. His navigator was killed, but he got the plane back to England. He retired as the chief meteorologist in the war room of the Pentagon. I don't get a lot of opportunity to talk about him. He's been gone for over 15 years now. Later in his life, he developed Lewy body disease. The symptoms of that manifest as sort of a combination of Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease. He spent his last years in a nursing home in Florida. In his final months, his advanced directive was overlooked three separate times. On one particular occasion, in the days before cell phones, my mother came home to find a message on her answering machine from the nursing home saying they had sent my father to the hospital. She rushed to the emergency room, and the ER doc came out to talk with her and said, we did everything we could and we were able to bring him back around. And she said, but what about his living will? The doctor went completely flush and said, he had no idea that my father had a living will. He had spent the last 45 minutes, I don't know how else to say it, beating on his body to get his heart going again. Because this happened three times in his final years, I know that this is a real problem. I really appreciate the work that this committee and others and the bill sponsors and co-sponsors have put into this bill. I ask the committee's support for it. It's a great opportunity to avoid the situation that my family went through. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Emily. Any questions? I don't see any. Thank you so much. We have the department here in public health, and they've been listening, and I'm giving this opportunity if they have something to enlighten us to step forward. Otherwise, we can ask questions if you have them of the department or division. Dr. Hurlburt, welcome. Pleasure to see you. It's snowing back in Anchorage. Where you would identify yourself for the record. And
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Ward Hurlburt. I'm the Director of Division of Public Health, Chief Medical Officer. I don't have prepared testimony, but I'm here to answer questions. The Governor's Office does not have a position on the bill, but I can say certainly from a clinician's perspective and a public health perspective, everybody should have a living will. And I think that the intent in bringing this up addresses that. How it's best to do it, I think, is up to the committee to decide. But if there are some specific questions, I'd be happy to answer those.
Great. Any questions for Dr. Hurlburt? Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you know how many hospitals in the state inquire? I know that whenever I go in for a test or anything else, one of the first questions that they ask is, do you have a living will and is it on file here at the hospital? And then they check to find out if it is. And so I'm wondering whether this is something that pretty much every hospital does, or is it only like Homer and here?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I do not specifically know the answer to that for Alaska, but based on a lot of years' experience being responsible for leading a number of hospitals, any hospital should ask that question. But as we just heard from Representative Holmes, that's not done. I suspect that it's possible that even with the legislation, the question might not be asked. You're in a time of a lot of stress. You're in an emergency there. But I think it's a failing of our healthcare system when that is not asked. And the example that Ms. Neenan gave of the tragedy with her dad there shows what happens. So I think that all of our hospitals are good hospitals in this state. They all would intend to ask that question. I suspect it would not happen 100% of the time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
No, my limited experience in the hospital, they've been very good about asking me the same question when you register. You know, when you register, is it on file? And I just wanted to put on the record that even though the hospitals are very helpful, all the actual forms, a lot of them are in the statute. You can actually look it up, and it was a lot of work. And as a staffer, I relate to James there. And, you know, the work that went into that was incredible. I'm not sure it's perfect, but you know, it's all there anyway. If anyone's interested,
Mr. Chairman, the ethical default in our society and in our system, the fallback position, is to try to keep people alive, and that's a positive ethical thing. The result of that sometimes is a tragedy, as we just heard from Ms. Neenan there, related to her dad, and tragedy in terms of suffering, tragedy in terms of just prolonging dying, tragedy in terms of incredible financial cost with no avail to it. But that's a part of why we deal with this. That's a good thing, having this ethical fallback that we value life and protect life, but sometimes the offshoot of that is a tragedy.
Yes. Thank you, and appreciate you sharing with us. Anyone else in the room that would like to talk about it? Thank you. We both on HB 209, this one, we're going to leave the testimony open because we anticipate coming back to this. Representative Seaton.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'd just like to have the sponsor, if they would, before the next hearing when this is heard, to survey the hospitals in the state or the hospital association and find out. Because I know that if you even go in for a blood test, you know, that's one of the first questions you're asked, and they have copies for you if you want to do one. You don't have to do it, but so it'd be interesting to find out what the default position of hospitals in this state is, or if they're all the same, or if that's something that's just individual hospitals. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Seaton. And Representative Millett.
Thank you. First, I just want to thank the sponsor. This is I've sponsored this bill both times that Representative Holmes has introduced it, and it's incredibly personal to me, this bill, and so I'm glad that you're bringing the subject up. End-of-life issues are some of the toughest, most emotional decisions you'll have to make, and I see this registry as a way of lifting burdens for those that have to face that, not just one time, but many times through the course of a debilitating and terminal illness. So I just wanted to say thank you for all your hard work. It's a pretty personal issue for me, and I'm just glad that we're talking about it, and I look forward to it passing next session. Thank you.
Okay, we'll set this bill aside this time. Thank you for coming. And Representative Guerra, if you will make your way up. Probably owe Representative Guerra an apology. He wanted to know if we should go with a CS or amendments. And I said, well, amendments, because amendments will help us understand the evolution of the bill. And anyway, that makes his job tougher. But my goal and intent is that we understand the bill. So thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Representative Lescarra, District 23, with my aide, Rose Foley. We worked during the session very hard on trying to come up with a fix on some of the remaining problems in the foster care system that wouldn't cost anything. So the bill has a zero fiscal note. We've worked with the department on it. The department doesn't object to the bill, as you've heard with most bills this year. We didn't get a statement of support, but we have a statement of we don't object, and they've worked very closely with us on the language, and that's why the amendment is here. Just to go backwards for a second, the amendment is something the Department of Law wanted. In large part, there have been technical changes to the foster care legislation over the last many years, and some of the words didn't catch up, and so we're the sort of host species that gets to fix, carry a lot of those changes. So that's what you'll see it mostly there. The bill does a few major things. Currently, there are too many stories that we hear of siblings being split up when they go into foster care. The statutes don't create a presumption that siblings have to stay together, so we've created a presumption that siblings stay together. It'll get enforced this way. If a social worker decides to split up siblings, they're going to have to offer an explanation, and a department supervisor is going to have to sign off on that and put that in the file. So they'll still be able to do what's in the best interest of the child, but we want to have the social worker know somebody's looking over their shoulder before they split up siblings. There is a problem in rural Alaska that sometimes you want the foster child to be as close to family members as possible. Sometimes in rural Alaska, a child gets sent to a big city because rural homes don't meet the code requirements that are in the statute for a foster home. There are code requirements. Some of those are non-waivable by federal law, and so we did a sponsor substitute to say we can't waive the ones that federal law says we can't waive. But there are things like in the regulations, OCS has a regulation that said sidewalks to the house have to remain ice-free. Well, that's not always going to happen. The department tries to waive where they can, but we have a rule that says these requirements can be waived if it's in the best interest of the child, and if the home is safe. So as long as the home is safe and it's in the best interest of the child, we want some of those bureaucratic things to be able to be waived. We had a provision that would allow OCS to enroll children in Imagination Library, but they've started to do that on their own, so we took that provision out of the bill. One of the most important parts of the bill was something Amanda Mativier, who's online, taught me about this summer. And she's responsible for this provision. The goal in foster care throughout the country is to get children into a permanent home. That's either an adoptive home or back to their original parents. It's not to bounce them between foster homes. That's the worst thing you can do. So permanency is what they call it in foster care, and that's always the goal. The department here, and they do this in other states, give up on permanency sometimes on a child and say, you know, we're just going to keep you in movable foster care, where it's just too hard to find you a permanent placement. Senator Charles Grassley from Iowa has taken a lead nationally on saying that's not acceptable. You can't give up on children. And so he has written draft federal legislation that hasn't gotten through that says unless there's a compelling reason, you always keep looking for a permanent home for a child. And so we've borrowed that federal language and said unless there's a compelling reason, you have to keep looking for a permanent home for a child. You can't just give up and say, we'll just put you in bounceable foster care. The system for taking children out of the permanency goal is called APLA. Another alternative placement is, well, somebody else will tell you what APLA stands for. Another planned permanent living arrangement is what APLA means. And the chair asked that we come up with a definition of APLA, so we have, and the department supports the definition that we came up with APLA, but the bottom line is APLA is what you do when you want to just give up on finding a permanent placement for a kid, and we don't want that to happen unless the department can establish a compelling reason. Senator Dyson came up with a provision that makes sense on this last thing the bill does. Sometimes youth are notified they're being bounced out of foster care at the last minute. And so we've said we want 30 days notice to the youth and the guardian ad litem. Senator Dyson said, well, what if the kid really wants out? So there's a provision in the amendment that Ms. Rutherdale will walk you through that says if all the parties agree, you could do it in quicker than 30 days. Just let the kid out of foster care right away. within one day, if all the parties agree. But otherwise, we want notice going to the youth and to the child that they're being bounced out of foster care. Because if you get bounced out too early, you lose your ability to get the post-foster care sort of success initiatives that you might qualify for, college tuition assistance, workforce training assistance, some early rental assistance, things like that. So we don't want kids bounced out without their knowledge or without their input. That's what the bill does. The amendment then does some housekeeping things beyond that that Jan Rutherdale from the Department of Law can explain since she wrote them. But that's all it does, and it comes with a zero fiscal note. The department, just interestingly, the director of OCS wrote something in a recent newsletter saying we use APLA too much, and we've got a it's not good for children. And so that's why they don't really oppose this bill, is they also have a goal to go back to the goal of permanency instead of this APLA system. That's it, unless you have any questions. And you probably have Amanda Mativier online, who has become quite an expert in this area from facing foster care.
We have several online, but you know, first we'll go, it's a committee, we'll ask questions. But
yep.
Where's the APLA definition? And I just haven't identified it here.
The APLA definition is in the amendment. And it is on page 4 on line 24.
Yeah, I got it. So it's an alternative, basically an alternative to permanent placement with an adult family member and alternative to reunification, adoption, and legal guardianship. So that kind of says what it isn't. But and this is more me trying to learn than messing with the language that you have provided. But it occurred to me that a living arrangement, you might think a mom and a dad, siblings, but it's more than that, isn't it? I mean, it could be quite different than that, right, in APLA?
APLA is usually just remaining to keep somebody in foster care with no guarantee that they're not going to get bounced to another house, or leaving somebody maybe a covenant house. That would be APLA. The goal is somebody who is going to be the permanent guardian or parent for the child. Okay. So that's the dividing line between the two.
Okay, thanks. Any other questions? Representative Katula.
Thank you. So we have children that actually have their foster care terminated without notice, and they just, in a matter of days, have no more foster care? Is that happening now?
You'll hear from Amanda Mativier that the department tries to avoid that, but there have been cases where children have received notice the day before their foster care is going to end. And the department tries to do better than that, but we want to have a statute that says they have to do better than that.
And again, just to comment, that needs to stop now, no matter whether we get this bill passed or not. Thank you.
Thanks. And I also want to thank our representatives Heron and Thomas for being prime sponsors on the legislation.
Okay. Seeing no other questions, if you are comfortable, just stay right there, and in that way you can, if questions come up. We'll start with Amanda. We no stranger to this committee. Amanda, are you online? And if you would, identify yourself and give us your testimony.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, great.
Okay. So for the record, my name is Amanda Mativier, and I'm the statewide coordinator of Facing Foster Care in Alaska. I'm calling to give testimony in support of House Bill 33 on behalf of FSPA. And I wanted to highlight a few of the things. I know you guys had some questions just now, and one of them was with regard to APLA. And I think the definition of what APLA is it's really long-term foster care. The term, another planned permanent living arrangement, replaced the language of long-term foster care when the Adoption and Safe Families Act passed in 1997. because they just didn't want it to sound like it was long-term foster care anymore, but it still realistically is. And this is the goal that youth get when they age out of the system. So the young people who are leaving at 18, 19, 20, and now 21 are the youth who have that goal of APLA. And this bill is passed with the restrictions on the use of APLA so that youth aren't aging out. Because what's happening right now is young people, as young as 15, 14, are getting this goal and that search for a permanent family through adoption or guardianship or even reunifying or returning home back with their own families stops. And so what happens is they just remain in the system until they age out at 18. So if this was passed, it wouldn't allow for that. And the search for permanency really shouldn't stop at 14, 15, 18, 20, 25. I mean, I think realistically, we still all need families. I'm 26, and I still very much need a family. I need a place to go on the holidays. I need parents to be the grandparents when I decide to have children. I need someone to walk me down the aisle someday when I get married. Everybody still needs parents, regardless of, you know, what their permanency goal is. I also wanted to highlight the release at 18. One of the things that was mentioned was youth being released from custody without notice. I've seen this happen a number of times. Back in November, I had a youth come to me on a Friday who had received a text message from one of the workers on her case who said she was out of custody. She didn't get a phone call. She didn't get notice of a court hearing. She got a text message saying, "You're dismissed." She spent the next 3 months homeless. She slept in a car. She couch surfed. She bounced around Anchorage until finally she's in a stable living situation now. There was also a young lady out in the Matsu Valley who wasn't notified of her court hearing as well and was released at 18. A month before she was supposed to start college again, had nowhere to go, ended up, luckily her CASA volunteer allowed her to come and stay with her out there for the month prior to her starting college. And then another thing that I wanted to highlight was the efforts to keep siblings together. I see a lot of siblings getting separated, and I know our state scored high on this on the Child and Family Services Review in terms of keeping siblings together, but we still see them separated for reasons that I don't think are good reasons to separate them. We had a youth recently who is the oldest of three, and he was separated from his two younger siblings. And it wasn't because they didn't have a foster home that would take all of them. It was because he was told that he had played the role of a parent to his two younger siblings for too long, and he needed time to be a kid. I was lucky in that I was placed with my younger sister, and I did spend the majority of my life raising her, and she just recently moved back in with me again for the fourth time, so I still play mom to her, and I think regardless of what that role is in terms of playing a parent to younger siblings, siblings should still stay together, and siblings who experience abuse and neglect together often have a stronger bond than, I guess, those who grow up in a normal, stable family. And for older siblings to be separated from younger siblings in that way, I think it's almost like having their own child taken away. So those are the things in the bill that I wanted to highlight. I'll stay on the lines a little bit if you guys have any questions for me. And I wanted to thank the committee for allowing time for testimony and to hear this bill.
Thank you, Amanda. It's always a pleasure to hear your testimony. Any questions for Amanda? Representative Cartula?
Do you know, is it just that the department failed to give them notice, or is there a notice requirement and that just didn't happen with the people who were, the kids who were just out of custody or termed out?
What happens is OCS is supposed to give notice to youth and to families of court hearings when they're coming up. But sometimes youth, I mean, they're highly mobile, so it really depends. I've had youth in my home, as a foster parent, I've had youth in my home, and we've gotten notice of a court hearing the day of the court hearing. So I don't know that there's anything in OCS policy that says, you know, all parties have to be notified within 30 days or something like that. I'm not really sure.
Okay, thank you. I also want to say thanks for your testimony, and this is a reason I really knew it was going to be hard on this committee. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Herron.
Yes, thanks, Chairman. Just a comment. Amanda, I just wanted to say that Alaska is blessed that you're an advocate for this cause. Thank you.
And I might add, if I could, Amanda, that your life is a demonstration of success in a struggle. You have shared that with us before, and thank you.
We have OCS here and Department of Law. If the committee has any questions for them, we can call them, ask them, give them the opportunity, whatever they would like. Looks like we got some volunteers. You want to identify yourself for the record, and your comments would be helpful. And again, this is in the context of Representative Gehr will no doubt, or we will work with him to put together a CS that has it all in one package. So we'll, and that's what I should have done to start with, and I apologize that I didn't, but that's where we'll go from here. And we anticipate working with you in that process. Representative Kasula?
Could I ask, since I think we have the amendment in front of us, that maybe we could go ahead and adopt that today at least and have Ms. Rutherford explain it, because I think they're ready to do that.
We could do that, but we could also, because of the fact that we're not looking to work the bill today, we can go ahead and just do that, I think, without the if you feel better, sure, go ahead and move it. Go ahead.
Thank you. Now, I'd like to move what I think is amendment number 127-L SO203/E.1, Michelle, if that's all right.
Right. Okay, amendment E.1, and that goes to the version E of the sponsor substitute for House Bill number 33. Is there any objections? See no objections. I think we will, if there are, they'll come up when we see the
CS.
Yeah, so thank you. Then we have adopted your amendments. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You bet. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tracy Spartz Campbell, and I'm the Deputy Director for the Office of Children's Services.
And my name is Jan Rutherdale, and I'm an Assistant Attorney General in the Child Protection Section of the Civil Division.
Okay, great. You want to start with the amendments?
Well, I'm basically here to answer questions. I can walk through the amendments if you want to, or I can answer questions about the bill in general.
Sure.
Maybe I can just go ahead and ask a question about the terming out and how the department handles that and what we can do to be sure that you don't have a child that's getting noticed the day before it happens and winding up homeless, because that's just unacceptable to me and I'm sure everybody else and you. So how you know, what is the process and what we can we do to assure that that doesn't happen?
I could answer that through the chair, Representative Kurtula. First off, I want to explain, just in response to some of the questions that were asked earlier, that there's two ways a custody or a child can leave the system when they're, you know, over 18. One is their term, the amount of their custody just ends. You know, they're termed out, as Representative Kurtula termed it. And then the other is, let's say there's custody until 18 and a half, and the child, or now adult, reaches 18, and they say, no, I want out now, or usually that's the initiating cause, and so there may be a motion to release custody early. And so one of the changes to these amendments is to separate out those two possible scenarios, and so the bill adds a new subsection R that addresses the end of custody provision, and then the other when you're trying to end it early, and that would be through motion work. But the result is the same. The spirit is the same. It gives notice in both instances. And I think what happens is it's in the when the custody just flat out expires, I think that's when the surprises come. Because obviously if you're trying, only the court can release custody earlier, so obviously you have to make a motion. You are required to notify the guardian ad litem. The guardian ad litem represents the child, so the child should be, well, best practice would always be to notify an older child anyway directly. And certainly the case or the statutes require that you notify, the department notify foster parents. So presumably the foster parents would tell the child. But this law goes a step further to say for the older child, not the two-year-old, that would be difficult to notify them, but for the older child, you're actually now required to give notice to them if they're available, because as a practical matter, sometimes you have children that, or adults, youth, that just flat out run away and they're gone, and it's very hard to notify them. So that's, I can say that in Juneau, probably for the last 15 or more years, we just have a calendar. I don't know if it was a request by the court or a guardian ad litem, but it was, we have been notifying them 30 days in advance. It's just a local practice, and we just calendar it so that we know 30 days before something, custody is about to lapse, and we'll send out notice to the parties and to the courts as a courtesy to let them know they can now put their file away in deep storage or whatever. Mm-hmm. But this will make it a statewide practice.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Can you explain to me a little bit why there would be different lengths of custodies? I mean, if they don't end on their 18th birthday, you're saying somebody custody might end at 18 and a half or something. What kind of variables are there where custodies would be at different times?
Okay, through the chair, Representative Seaton. I think the answer is because custody of a child could be taken at any time, and so let's say the child is 14 and a half when their custody is taken, and by the time you get the disposition order, maybe they're 15 and a quarter, and you can only have custody up to 2 years, so now they're 17 and a quarter, and then after that, if you need custody further, you can only get it up to a year, so then they'd be 18 and a quarter. See what I mean? So that's why a child could be... they could be, and it could be any time up to 1 year for that extension. So if all the parties said, no, we really want this custody to end on their 18th birthday, we can certainly do that. We just can't go beyond a year for those extensions of custody. We just have to keep coming back to court to ask for further time.
And so is a normal procedure that it just goes on calendar, on calendar year extensions instead of anything related to the age of the child?
Through the chair, I would think that would be it varies with the case, but usually, I know I can say from my own practice, usually it's up to the year. I mean, you get the maximum amount knowing that you can be flexible and ask the court for less time if that's in the best interest of the child.
Thank you,
Chair. Representative Herron.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess down on when I got to thinking about this noticing provision, so best practice is that currently is 30 days?
Through the chair, Representative Herron, really, the child is getting more than 30 days because it's 30 days notice prior to filing the motion, but then motion work, if no one opposes, that's at least 10 days, and if there's a full motion and opposition and all that, we're talking more like 30 days. So really, the child is getting like 60 days with this provision, if that makes sense.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Tracy, how many are in foster care now in the state of Alaska?
Well, on the average right now, it's about 1,200 children in foster care.
And how many of those 1,200 are over 18?
I'm not sure of that number, but I can certainly get back to you with that.
Ballpark?
Ballpark, I'd say it's about 100.
About 100. I still have the question in my mind. I'll work with a sponsor on this. In fact, I'll call Amanda and just chat with her, but I'm still trying to envision, in that range, that those children that are over 18, under 21, there's things, there's rent assistance, some, right? And there's programs that they're in and all that. And I'm just trying to grasp, just how much
adult-loving adult supervision there is, you know, and I mean, just typically, you know, what's typical? Is there a typical? I admit my ignorance, and I'd love, I need to pursue this myself more. Any other questions? Go ahead.
And how many, what's the percentage of those kids in actual foster homes? I mean, there's our break on that. Or are those the kids in foster homes?
Well, if they're in our custody, more than likely they are in foster care or some type of alternative placement. But I don't have the breakdown, actually, and I'd get that for you.
Okay, but there's hundreds, obviously hundreds and hundreds of foster homes.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Seeing no further questions, thank you. And thank you to the sponsor. And we're adjourned at 4:45, April 7th.